Hi, this is John Harcher, and welcome to episode 25 of Keep On Grooving. Jimi Hendrix is a towering figure in rock history, but he didn't achieve that status all by himself. There were a lot of people along the way who contributed their talents to help him achieve that masterful sound. We'll go over the lives and careers of some of the most important of them today, and some more next time, but we'll get to that later. Episode 25, Hendrix's Helpers, Part 1. I know, not a great title, but we'll make up for it as we go along. For the next couple of episodes, we're going to concentrate on the professional portion of Jimi Hendrix's life. Of course, his mom and dad were important in his development. And his girlfriends, you know, just between Fanny Pridgeon, Kathy Etchingham, Devin Wilson, and Monica Dandeman, they're a show all to themselves. Never mind the other ladies in his sphere. Eva Sundquist comes to mind, let alone Cynthia Plastercaster, but I'm trying not to turn off the clean switch on the podcast, so let's not go there. We can give a tip of the hat to Linda Keith, since she was the one who got Jimmy onto people's radar. She was the inspiration for the song Ruby Tuesday while she was dating Keith Richards, and had a rough run like too many people did in that era, falling into drug addiction. But thankfully, she's still with us. It was through her that Chaz Chandler entered the picture. Chaz Chandler was born in Newcastle, England in 1938. His path towards music started when he joined the Alan Price set in 1962. That band later added a singer a year later in the form of Eric Burdon. One story goes band leader Graham Bond saw their stage act and called them Animals. However, Eric says their new name came from a friend of his. Either way, the name stuck and the Animals began to make a dent on the charts along with the Beatles, Rolling Stones, Who, Kinks, and other British bands of the era. Their greatest success was an organ-drenched cover of the old folk song House of the Rising Sun. It left a big impression on Chaz's later career as a producer. When Jimmy would go on and on doing take after take, Chaz would throw out the line, "We did House of the Rising Sun in 20 minutes and it hit number one." The Animals began to fall apart when founder Alan Price left the band. He started another band, the Alan Price Set, that had a hit of their own that has an odd tie to Jimmy. Remember that time when Jimmy was going to do Burning the Midnight Lamp on a TV show and another song started playing instead? That song was Alan Price's House that Jack Built. You see how these things all tie together? Anyway, Price later played with band leader Georgie Fame, who has a connection to another player we'll be talking about soon. Now, back to Chaz. The original Animals broke apart in 1966 due to money issues. The band had been working for years, but barely had any cash to their name. Chandler decided to move behind the glass and produce artists himself. This is what led to his being asked by Linda Keith to come down to the Café Wa and see the new guitar player she'd seen. He saw Jimmy, and the rest is history. He put the experience together and produced them for a little less than 2 years before leaving when Jimmy's work and personal habits made creation of music difficult. But he didn't completely shut himself off from the band. He was in consultation with them during the Royal Albert Hall run, as we mentioned last episode, did speak to Jimmy in the days before he died. In 1969, Chaz was made aware of an up-and-coming band named Slade and signed on to manage them. He ended up staying with them for 12 years and numerous number one hits in the UK, making them on paper and probably financially his biggest success. They were best known for song titles with very odd misspellings long before Prince came on the scene. One of them would provide them with big success in the U.S., though not their version of that song. Slade had a dip in popularity in the late 70s before making a comeback in the early 80s, subbing for Ozzy Osbourne at one of the festivals. A projected comeback single, however, failed to do well on the charts, and the band blamed Chaz, leading to his firing. A couple years later, Ozzy's guitar player's former band decided to release their cover of Slade's Come On Feel the Noise. The single shot up the charts and was all over MTV, giving Quiet Riot, the the first heavy metal number one album with Metal Health. This led to their label CBS to sign Slade, who then had their biggest hit in the U.S. with Run Runaway. See how everything ties together? Just everything's all connected. Chaz then stepped back into the Hendrix world in the mid-80s by having Jimmy's former bandmates come in and dub new performances over some old unreleased tapes. Huh. Sounds like something someone else will talk about did, and well, it didn't go over very well. He spent the last 10 years of his life out of the limelight, but speaking about Jimmy quite a bit. Unfortunately, Chaz passed away in 1996 of an aneurysm. He did leave a secret that wasn't to come out until his passing, that he played bass on Hey Joe. It's open for debate if that was actually the case. Now, considering how much of a shambles the Animals finances were, it's a little surprising Chaz went to manager Mike Jeffrey, since they basically blamed him for their poor financial condition. But he was desperate, so he brought him into the fold. Jeffrey was a little older than Chaz, born in 1933 in London. Now, while he did work for the intelligence services in his youth, the story that he was a member of MI5 doesn't look like it was true. He began his foray into the music industry by running a couple of clubs in Northern England. One of them was regularly frequented by Eric Burdon, leading to his getting the eventual Animals playing in it. Now, at one point, the clubs had to be closed due to running afoul of regulations. Then, oddly enough, both of them ended up burning down. Imagine that. Since the band had played his clubs often, Jeffrey ended up managing the Animals, getting them in with producer Mickey Most. He then had them go out on the road. A lot. I mean, constantly out, so they would really only have about 20 minutes to record House of the Rising Sun. Many years later, the band realized Mike hadn't done a really good job with the finances. Any of this sound vaguely familiar? When Chaz wanted to produce and manage Jimmy, he realized A, he needed financial help to do it, and B, he really only knew one person who had the resources to do it. So he begrudgingly brought Mike in to do the finances. Mike had set up a publishing arm called Yameda and had Jimmy sign on to them. Yameda, of course, was based in that well-known mecca of the music industry, the Bahamas. Nice place to park things like cars and planes and cash. We've touched quite a bit on Jeffrey's tenure with Jimmy. He did make the band do a lot of touring to keep finances coming in. He did co-sign with Jimmy for Electric Lady Studios to help get that built. He did fire Buddy Miles, some say at Jimmy's behest, and wanted to get the experience back together. He did also come up with that great idea for Jimmy to get involved with the film Wave, later called Rainbow Bridge. As I mentioned last episode, I don't think Mike had anything to do directly with Jimmy's death. Once Jimmy passed away and they tried to figure out what to do with his pile of tapes, Mike's main contribution seemed to have been pulling songs off of already set albums. Dolly Dagger and Rueful of Mirrors were pulled off of Cry Love to go on Rainbow Bridge. Stepping Stone and Isabella were pulled off of Rainbow Bridge to go on a later album that became War Heroes. The stereo mix of The Stars That Play with Laughing Sam's Dice gets pulled from War Heroes to go on What Would Become Blue Sand. And of course, he also gave Eddie Kramer and John Jansen the World Ever Hall tapes for use on In the West and got them embroiled in the ongoing legal issues. What a guy. Jeffrey was killed in a mid-air collision over Nantes, France in 1973. The crash was so bad, it's got its own page on Wikipedia. This would sort of put to rest any thinking he used the crash to fake his death and live happily off the money he'd taken from the band. Mike's assistant was Trixie Sullivan. She was there for a lot of the fun stories involving Jimmy and Mike, as well as providing a lot of information from a pretty trustworthy source. So if you see anything from Trixie, you kind of know that's solid info. When Chaz and Mike were trying to get a band together for Jimmy, they did it under the guise of having players audition for the new Animals. One of the musicians who showed up was Noel Redding. He was a Christmas baby, born on December 25th, 1945, up in Kent. He studied various instruments such as the violin and mandolin before moving on to guitar. You know, there's a decent-sized subgroup of British rock musicians who played other non-rock instruments, you know, Jack Bruce, John Entwistle, Rick Gretsch. Might have been interesting for Noel to break out the old violin on a track or two on one of the Experience records, but didn't happen. Now, when Noel auditioned for the band, he thought he was signing up for the New Animals. Having played in various bands over the past 5 years or so, he was a quick study, and even though he'd never played bass before, he agreed to give it a try to be in the band. It also helped that Jimmy liked his frizzy perm hairdo. He did play guitar on the CBS studio version of Red House on the UK mono version of Are You Experienced, but he turned it into a bass for all intents and purposes. He was an aspiring songwriter and was able to get the band to record a number of songs, though only She's So Fine and Little Miss Strange made the records. As we mentioned many times over the episodes, Noel wasn't thrilled staying in the studio, preferring to play live. Plus, Jimmy's staggered work habits, shifting between having parties in the studio and doing umpteen takes, began to get on his nerves in early 1968 when he left the sessions for All on the Watchtower, leaving bass duties to first Dave Mason, then Jimmy himself on the finished track. By mid-1969, Jimmy and Noel's relationship had strained to the point where Jimmy spoke of adding musicians into the band. Noel decided to leave at the end of the spring tour and started his own band, Fat Mattress, with his old friend Neil Landon. This lasted only around a year, with Noel leaving in 1970. This is why he was possibly available for a United Experience in both early and late 1970. Work on a solo album, as we mentioned, didn't get very far. After Jimmy's death, he put together another band, Road, but it didn't last, as well as his own Noel Redding band, also known as the Conocalifty Cowboys, after his new hometown in Ireland. He didn't end up appearing in the 1973 film about Jimi Hendrix, reportedly over a pay dispute. Around the time of Mike Jeffries' passing, Noel signed away his rights to any future Hendrix releases and was later practically assured there would be no more future releases. Well, we see how that turned out. His music career was sputtering out, but one good thing was his meeting Carol Appleby. The two would remain together for the better part of 2 decades. She helped him put together an autobiography called Are You Experienced? Right after they finished, however, the two were involved in a car accident which rendered Carol brain dead. Noel faced the agonizing decision of taking her off of life support soon after. The book itself came out around 1992. It wasn't released in the States at that point, but I happened to take a trip to England and Scotland that year and picked it up at a bookstore right near Earl's Court. I got the chance to read it in Scotland while on the train from Edinburgh to Dundee to visit my mom's college roommate. Got the chance to actually go over the Firth of Forth Bridge, and because I was reading the book, I didn't have Genesis sticking in my head. You know, Noel had some nice descriptions of his time in Ireland, going down to hang around the pub from like early afternoon to late at night. You know, it sounded kind of fun once, but it seems Noel did this more than a few times a week. This led to alcoholism that took him years to get over. The autobiography helped him in that process. By the time the 90s came around, Noel began to re-embrace his time with the Experience, appearing on the In From the Storm tribute album and having Fender create a jazz-based version of his own instrument from his time in the Experience. Unfortunately, legal issues still abounded, and Noel was in the process of suing Experience Hendrix over royalty payments when he passed away in May 2003 of what turned out to be cirrhosis of the liver, likely brought upon by his years of drinking. To me, it seemed Noel was always trying to be John Lennon, at least the pre-Sgt. Pepper's version. They were both in skiffle bands when they were young. That was a big thing in the late 50s in England. I'm still not exactly sure what the hell that was. His songs weren't purely romantic, as say, like Paul McCartney's songs were, or anywhere near as psychedelic as Jimmy's. He did have an outlet for his material, but he seemed to think it could just stand on its own. I mean, it's okay, but there's not a lot to make it stand out of the crowd once you don't have one of the greatest guitar players ever doing solos in it. Being with Jimmy and the swirl of chaos around him certainly can take a toll, as we'll see when we get to his other bass player. It's a shame he didn't get a chance to enjoy this part of his career more, but as part of the experience, his contributions will last forever. The drummer's chair for the experience came down to Ainsley Dunbar and Mitch Mitchell. I prefaced Ainsley earlier as the perennial just outside of mainstream success Ainsley Dunbar. I mean, just take a look at this guy's career. After losing out on the experience on the flip of a coin, he plays with John Mayall for a little bit and gets replaced by Mick Fleetwood. So if he had ended up staying a little longer, Peter Green may have dragged him off and it would have been called Dunbar Mac a few years later. He starts his own band, Retaliation, which really doesn't go anywhere, but their song Warning is covered by Black Sabbath on their debut album and makes their greatest hits, you know, We Sold Our Soul for Rock and Roll, so everybody knows that. Soon after the Retaliation broke up, he joins Frank Zappa for a few years, and if anyone defines outside of the mainstream, it's Frank Zappa. He then joins former Santana band members Greg Raleigh and Neil Sean in their new effort, a band named Journey. He stays with them through 1978 when they bring on a new singer named Steve Perry. They record the Infinity album with the classics Wheel in the Sky and Lights. Dunbar leaves at that point. Guess he didn't think the singer would work out. Someone should have told him, don't stop believing. He joins Jefferson Starship when Mickey Thomas came into the band. He's on things like Jane and Find Your Way Back, so you've heard him on those songs. As a session musician, he played on Shuggie Otis's Freedom Flight album, but it's not clear if he was on that album's most famous song, the original version of Strawberry Letter 23. He's definitely not on the Brothers Johnson remake, that's for sure, that everybody knows. In the 80s, he played on some sessions with David Coverdale's post-Deep Purple band, Whitesnake. This is probably his greatest mainstream success, being on the number one song, Here I Go Again, and the number two song, Is This Love? But when you watch the videos with Tawny Gitane, God rest her soul, writhing all over the place, you hear Dunbar, but see Tommy Aldridge's distinctive afro. Poor guy can't catch a break. But he's still with us, so tip of that to him. Now to the guy who did make the band. John Mitch Mitchell was already very experienced when he got the job playing drums in the band. He was an actor as a youngster, having been the star of his own show, Jennings at School. This is similar to another drummer in a band at the time over in the States. It kind of echoes Mickey Dolenz's time as Circus Boy, which I never knew the show existed until I saw it on MeTV one time. Anyway, Mitch Mitchell became a session drummer, playing on quite a number of them. He almost ended up on Track Records earlier than he did with The Experience. He filled in a number of times with The Who, or maybe it was High Numbers at that point, before Keith Moon joined. His main steady gig was with Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames, which is funny because at the same time Jimmy's band in the Village was called Jimmy James and the Blue Flames. Even then, it was clear Mitch took great inspiration from jazz drummers like Elvin Jones and his circular style. You know, he held down the beat but kept it flowing so it wasn't just four on the floor timekeeping. It gave Jimmy's music a great compliment. During the quiet period at the end of 1968, Mitch got the chance to join Noel's idol John Lennon, Jimmy's buddy Eric Clapton, and Keith Richards doing his Noel Redding imitation as a guitarist playing bass in the Dirty Macs, the band that performed Your Blues at the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. When The Experience broke up in 1969, Mitch stayed around for the Gypsy Sons and Rainbows era from Woodstock through mid-September. He then signed up to do a tour with Jack Bruce and Larry Coryell, which left him unavailable to do the Fillmore East New Year's Eve shows, opening the door to Buddy Miles and the band of Gypsies. When they broke up, Mitch returned and stayed with Jimmy until his passing in September. After Jimmy's death, Mitch stayed on to help put together the first two posthumous albums, Cry of Love and Rainbow Bridge. He not only did some production work, but also got behind the drum kit and cleaned up a few things. For Angel, he went in and doubled his original drum part, giving it a really big sound. While preparing songs for Rainbow Bridge, he went in and dubbed over both parts of his own, as well as other drummers who played with Jimmy. Drum redubs of Somewhere and Tax Free were not released at the time, but made it out later. He did his own drum parts for the songs Earth Blues, Stepping Stone, and the as-yet-to-be-released Roomful of Mirrors, though I think a snippet of it is actually in the film. The question is, exactly when were these done? There is some idea they may have been done in June 1970, right after Electric Lady Studios opened. But there's also speculation these were done after Jimmy died. Now, if we got in the Electric Lady box set like we were supposed to, we might know the answer to these questions. But we'll just have to wait. After that, Mitch played in a few bands, but nothing achieved major success. He almost made it into Wings, but ironically lost the gig on a coin flip. He had one scene in the Jimi Hendrix film, which wasn't all that flattering. His playing did seem to diminish quite a bit in the 1971 era, as we hear on the version of Somewhere from the Purple Box. He never did quite get the rhythm of the song. His most important posthumous contribution may yet to actually come to fruition. During the European tour, Jimmy gave Mitch a bandana wrapped around 7 cassette tapes. A bunch of these were gigs, but one of them contained some demos Jimmy wanted his input on possible percussion ideas. That tape is the mythic Black Gold tape. It was thought to have disappeared, but Mitch went through his memorabilia years later and discovered the tapes. Experienced Hendrix has them now. We've heard one song from it and are still waiting for more. Mitch was a mainstay on the early Experienced Hendrix tribute tours. He did practically the whole tour in 2008 despite having trouble with autoimmunity disease. Unfortunately, it took a toll on him, and although people wanted him to take a break and get help, he thought he just needed some rest. He passed away just a few weeks before what would have been Jimmy's 66th birthday. Some of my favorite bits of him are in the 1988 MTV rockumentary produced by my phone pal and former boss Bonnie's best friend, Linda Cardina. I'll tell that story when we do videos, probably an episode sometime next year. His recounting of the recording of The Wind Cries Mary and The Lulu Show are how I remember them. He had a great way of telling a story. He is missed. Now, Jimmy had all these crazy sounds in his head and didn't know how to get them recorded and onto an album. Luckily for him, he ended up working with one guy who could help him out. Eddie Kramer was an up-and-coming engineer at the time and would soon go on to become a legend in the recording world. He was born in Cape Town, South Africa, and his parents ended up moving to London. He first got involved with recording at Abbotson Studios, moving over to Pi a year later when the Kinks were starting out. A solo venture was bought out by Regent Sound, and he ended up there in time to help the Beatles record Fixing a Hole for Sgt. Pepper's. In 1967, when he'd move over to Olympic, he helped them out again on a couple of other little numbers, Baby You're a Rich Man and All You Need Is Love. So for those, Mr. Martin had a little help from a friend. During his tenure working with Jimmy, Eddie made the move from Olympic to the record plant in New York. He also had the monster job of recording the entire Woodstock Festival. Later in 1969, one of his last jobs at the record plant was helping another Jimmy, Jimmy Page, mix a little album called Led Zeppelin II. Eddie would go on to mix Houses of the Holy and actually make the record on Physical Graffiti. He's the guy talking about the airplane at the beginning of Black Country Woman, you know. Jimmy, what do you want us to do about this plane? You know, Robert Plant goes, nah, leave it. Once Electric Lady opened up, he worked there through the mid-70s, working on a variety of albums from Carly Simon's debut record, Curtis Mayfield's live album, as well as Derek and the Dominoes in Concert and Humble Pie's performance, Rockin' the Fillmore. In 1973, he produced a four-song demo for a local band who had an interesting gimmick. They performed in makeup and crazy outfits. 2 years later, they came back looking to put together a live album. That band, of course, was Kiss, and the album was Kiss Alive. He did their next three, or four if you count double platinum, albums, as well as Ace Frehley's solo record, generally considered the best of the four, and the one that had the hit single with New York Groove. He left Electric Lady and worked on an album for Peter Frampton, a live record called Frampton Comes Alive. He also worked with Zeppelin one final time on the song Remains the Same soundtrack album. Eddie certainly had a touch for the mid-70s live records, didn't he? He continued working through the 80s, but didn't have much contact with Jimmy's material during the Alan Douglas era. His reintroduction of sorts was Stone Free, the 1993 tribute album. He also did the 1995 tribute album, In From the Storm. Right around that time, Al Hendricks regained the rights to Jimmy's work, and the new company Experience Hendricks brought Eddie on board to help them get things going in the right direction, and he's been there ever since. While there have been a number of questionable decisions over the years, I do feel better having someone like Eddie there, having worked with Jimmy, and with his overall experience, he's been a steady hand. He's also a great storyteller. I've said that if they had Eddie sit at the mixing board and talk about every song in Jimmy's catalog, you'd never get me to leave the TV or website. At some point, he's going to have to slow down and one day stop. It'll be a sad day, but thankfully, that day hasn't come yet. He's actually worked on the next album coming out, the LA concert album from 1969. So he's still cracking. Before we close today's episodes, I want to quick mention a few of the other engineers who helped Jimmy achieve his sound. First, it was Dave Seidel, head engineer over at Kingsway, aka Delaney Leah Studios. He'd done a lot of pop recording, so he knew how to get a good sound out of a band. His miking techniques allowed for the dumping of four tracks onto two to open things up for overdubs on things like Manic Depression and Fire, as well as the other tracks that got additional work done with Eddie over at Olympic. He even got to work with the Beatles on It's All Too Much. Unfortunately, Dave passed away about a decade or so ago. Someone over on the Hoffman boards actually knew his family and confirmed the sad news when his name came up. Now, Mike Ross over at CBS Studios only worked on the two sessions with Jimmy, but his handiwork is there in one of his most famous songs, Foxy Lady. Mike also engineered the mono Red House that appeared on the UK Are You Experienced. As for other bands, probably one of his other most famous pieces of work is on the Who's I Can See for Miles. He did the basic track for that. He also did a lot of the early Peter Green era Fleetwood Mac recordings. And also via the Hoffman boards, it turns out Mike is still with us and active. He actually just replied to a post this past weekend, so he's still out there and going. It's just a shame he didn't get to do more with Jimmy. He had a really good way of dealing with his sound. Thanks, Mike. Hope to talk to you later. For Electric Ladyland, Eddie's partner in crime was Gary Kellgren, one of the heads of the record plant. He'd first become acquainted with Jimmy when Chaz brought the band over to Mayfair Studios in New York to try to re-record Burning of the Midnight Lamp and the Stars Played Laughing Sam's Dice after the LA sessions didn't turn out too well. The next year, Gary opened up the record plant and was able to get Eddie Kramer to come over with Jimmy to record Electric Ladyland there. Basically, whatever Eddie didn't do, it was Gary. Long Hot Summer Night in particular, since Eddie wasn't able to come over for like a month. So it was like that was one of the first things he did. So if you had to pick a song that had Gary's sound on it, it's that one. Now, all of the biggest names in music ended up coming through the record plant. Later on, he opened up a West Coast version where most famously Fleetwood Mac recorded Rumors. Now, right around the time that record came out, a la Spinal Tap, Gary died in a bizarre drowning incident. It appeared he went down to the bottom of his pool to fix some speakers he had put underwater there and electrocuted himself. Then his girlfriend, who was in a raft at the time, also got electrocuted and passed away as well. Horrible, horrible ending there. Now, the TTG sessions were a bit uncomfortable right from the start due to a little clash of engineers. Jimmy had worked on one of Mike Jeffries' bands, Heir Apparent. They were recording an album, so he worked on the sessions with head engineer Jack Hunt. Jack was a solid but kind of by-the-books guy. You know, everything had to be recorded separately. Everything had to be, you know, just everything had to be in the right place at the right time. But Jimmy needed to have someone who was a bit more on the fly, a little looser. So he asked the other engineer, Angel Ballastier, to do his sessions. when Angel just happened to walk into a room to get the cable when Jimmy and Jack were still working. This caused a huge issue between the two engineers that actually, according to Angel, never went away. His handiwork is best heard on Look Over Yonder. You can tell his specific sound probably best on that track. When Gypsy, Sons and Rainbows went into the Hit Factory to do some recording, Eddie was the head engineer and he was assisted by Joey Zagarino. Those of you in the bootleg world know Joey's voice pretty well. He's on the Isabella session saying, "Oh, I don't have a four-track splicer, man. You could do it again." And he also tells the band during Easy Blues, "Rolling, rolling, rolling." We'll talk about the early band to Gypsy sessions next episode. When Jimmy, Billy, and Buddy went back to the record plant for December and January, they had a revolving band of assistant engineers, including Bob Cotto, Jack Adams, Dave Ragno, and Bob Hughes, who helped Jimmy mix the first version of Power Soul in February. Over at Electric Lady, when that finally opened, Eddie was first assisted by Dave Palmer. He'd actually been a drummer with Ted Nugent in his Amboy Dukes days and lived right across the street from the studio. The night it first opened, Jimmy brought Steve Winwood and Chris Wood over to have a look. The two Traffic bandmates recorded their backing vocals for Easy Rider. Then everybody wanted to jam, so they gave Dave a call and told him, "Come on over and play the tubs." For the mixing sessions in August, Kim King was the second engineer for most of those. So there was a host of help behind the scenes. Next time, we'll talk about the touring and post-experience parts of Jimmy's career and discuss Jerry Stickles, Buddy Miles, Billy Cox, and yes, Alan Douglas. That's next time on Keep On Grooving. Please hit the subscribe button if you like what you're hearing. I'm John Hartrett. Thanks for listening. Part 2 coming soon.